Getting political consensus and making practical progress can be hard work for the mayor of any city. And we turn next to our series taking a look at how cities are being run in this challenging economy. NPR's Noah Adams met the mayor of Marion, Indiana.
Wayne Siebold is a Republican, 47 years old, now in his second term. His city, Marion, is in north central Indiana, 30,000 people who've been through a tough economy. But now, on a drive around in the mayor's car, you can see progress, the promise. Here's a small example. Siebold's wife is from San Francisco, and she's been looking for a certain reassurance.
You know, she'd tell me, if we don't get a Starbucks, I'm leaving. So we went after Starbucks pretty hard, and there they are. And it's one of the top-performing stores in the region.
The town is happy that a Kohl's department store is coming. People will see the mayor shopping in the grocery store and say, when are we going to get a Target, a Texas Roadhouse, a Panera? Marion, Indiana believes brand names help bring factories. The mayor says it's a holistic approach to job creation.
You know, it's so expensive to take your families to a sporting event or to a Broadway-type show or those types of things that a lot of us have replaced entertainment with eating out and shopping.
And this is always a stop on the mayor's tour. It's the Splash House.
Swim! Kick your feet!
The mayor said, let's spend $5 million on a water park in town. We'll enjoy it and be proud of ourselves. The next morning, I went to Wayne Siebold's house to watch an ice skating video. The mayor's three young boys were waiting out front.
Welcome into our house.
Come on in, guys. This is Joey. He's blind. He won't hurt you.
I met Joey the dog and Wayne's wife Jennifer, and we turned on the television to see some of the 1988 Olympic Winter Games. Wayne Siebold, with his sister Kim, skating in Calgary.
This was our long program at the Olympic Games.
Does that seem real that that's you on the television?
No, that's about 35 pounds ago.
After the Olympics, Siebold spent a few years putting ice shows together. And he knew he wanted a small-town Indiana family life, and soon he moved back home to Marion. He'd grown up here in a trailer park, the south side, the factory side of town. And right here is the spot where a new economic dream was born.
This is probably the most blighted building and property we have in Marion today, and it's one of those old reminders of kind of where we were as a city.
It's now a mostly empty, huge factory that once made tube television sets. Siebold was the new mayor in the spring of 2004 when this place shut down.
980 people on that day lost their job. They came to work and the doors were locked.
The mayor helped his city decide it was time to go after new, diverse industries, offer land and buildings almost free, and really pay attention to the companies you've already got. When General Motors started laying off workers and turning off lights in several states, Siebold said, "Don't shut down your Marion stamping plant. And we'll get tax breaks to help you expand." The door stayed open. The expansion meant 500 new jobs. Quite often in the City Hall conference rooms, you can hear Chinese. These men are in the furniture business. Mayor Siebold had first met them on one of his 7 trips to China. Now they're setting up in an old Kmart building. The mayor wants to sell and live in a city that is itself a good business model. Marion's unemployment rate is down. So is the city payroll, down 100 people, and that's by attrition. The mayor has cut the budget and balanced the books.
We didn't have an IT department. Now we do. We were doing all the trash. Now we don't.
The IT folks found the city was paying for 100 phone lines it didn't need. And the trash? Now it's privatized.
We have 22 parks in our system. Well, we don't need 22 parks. We're selling parks.
Selling parks, giving them away. So you won't have to go around and mow all that grass. The goal is 5 big parks, parks that people drive to.
Years ago, you had to have a neighborhood park in every neighborhood because people walk. But it's a different world today. And I think that's what we have to do with the federal government.
As for Washington, Mayor Wayne Siebold wants sharper thinking, less regulation. Although he has managed to put $4 million federal dollars to work, building a new water system helped Marion bring in $150 million in business development. Noah Adams, NPR News.
The economic upheaval of the last several years has had a big impact on the nation's politics at every level. In Florida's Miami-Dade County, it's changed the entire tone of local government. As part of our series looking at the challenges faced by the nation's mayors, NPR's Greg Allen has this report.
Carlos Jimenez has been a fixture in Miami-Dade County for many years as a member of the Board of County Commissioners, before that as city manager and fire chief in the city of Miami. But now he suddenly finds himself in a new job.
I, Carlos A. Jimenez, do solemnly swear. That I will support.
On July 6, Jimenez was sworn in as the mayor of Miami-Dade County. It's Florida's most populous county, with 50 departments, 27,000 public employees, and a $6 billion annual budget. It's a job he ran for and won after the earlier mayor, Carlos Alvarez, was recalled. That recall in March was part of a national wave of voter anger over taxes. The former mayor, Jimenez recalls, pushed through a budget that during a time of high unemployment and falling housing prices raised property taxes and gave salary increases to unionized public workers.
It was unfortunate for the taxpayer because they had to pay more. It was unfortunate for the mayor.
Shortly after the county commission approved that budget, a recall campaign started that eventually ousted the mayor. Jimenez, a just-the-facts kind of guy, never known for his wit or sense of humor, voted against that budget. He's often been a dissenting voice on the county commission, opposing government spending plans. In that recall, he recognized an opportunity.
You know, Miami-Dade County is no different than the rest of the country. There was a groundswell against increasing taxes. There was a groundswell against labor unions in terms of their contracts and all that. And so I just don't think that some of the powers to be, you know, in the county hall, they were listening to what really was going on, and it cost them their jobs.
Jimenez won a special election, and one of his first acts was to produce a county budget nearly 20% less than the current $7.6 billion. The plan rolls back property taxes, cuts 1,300 county jobs, and depends on more than $200 million in concessions by police, firefighters, and other unionized employees. Jimenez concedes that last piece, asking workers to pay more for health care and retirement, and at the same time to accept a salary cut, will be tough for unions to swallow.
I fully expect that we're going to go to impasse with labor. I will try to work with them as much as I can to see how we can work things out, and a lot of it is due to is counting on those concessions.
The final word on those cuts rests with members of the county commission. The commission, though, has already given the mayor's plan preliminary approval and now has little wiggle room left. Commission Chair Joe Martinez says his main concern is with county workers on the low end of the wage scale.
When you add up the concessions that will be taken, some people it's about 20% cut. When you're talking $40,000 that you make a year, you're leaving some people with $32,000. And these are people who are residents, taxpayers, who have mortgages, rents, they pay the light bill, the phone bill, everything else just like you and I do.
Given the message of the recall and the county commission's near unanimous support of Mayor Jimenez's austerity budget, even the public employees' unions seem resigned to the cuts. Greg Blackman represents some 5,000 county professionals who are members of the Government Supervisors Association. In a county where the unemployment rate is near 14%, he believes these cuts aren't good for his members or for the county economy. It's no surprise, he says, that they're being proposed by Jimenez, a longtime fiscal hawk. What's disappointed Blackman and other union leaders is how the rest of the county commission has fallen into line behind the mayor.
There is a fear in the commission. They're scared of being recalled, so they're making decisions that are not really based on what's best for the county. They're making these decisions, I think, based on fear.
As a reform candidate, Jimenez says he'll also work to change the county charter to impose term limits on county commissioners, plus restrictions on lobbying and a ban on outside work. He has limited time. In winning a special election, Jimenez knows that he has just over a year to carry out his agenda before going back to the voters once again.
They're taking me out for a test drive, and so I better hit all the gears and I better make all the turns. I have a listing of what I said that I would do. I'm going to do it, and then the voters will decide next November.
Jimenez is currently holding a series of town meetings where voters have a chance to kick his tires and look under his hood. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. In the coming days, we'll see if we face consequences after Congress pushed the nation to the brink of failing to pay its bills.
Stock prices that started sliding during the crisis have continued falling this week. Investors are responding to bad economic news.
And then there's the compromise that went along with this week's increase in federal borrowing authority. The deal is designed to scale back federal spending over a decade, yet the long-term projections for the federal deficit are much larger than the deal, NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
President Obama went to the Rose Garden yesterday to celebrate the deal. Well, not exactly celebrate, but to mark the culmination of weeks of battles.
This compromise guarantees more than $2 trillion in deficit reduction. It's an important first step to ensuring that as a nation, we live within our means.
But among Washington's professional deficit watchers, this deal wasn't exactly a cork-popping moment. Diane Lim Rogers is the chief economist at the Concord Coalition, a nonpartisan group that pushes for deficit reduction.
It sounds good, sounds big, but unfortunately, our fiscal challenges are much greater than that.
What she's getting at here is this deal doesn't cut the nation's debt, not even close. It just slows the growth. Even with all these cuts, the government will still spend more each year than it's bringing in. Much more.
All we've done with this debt limit deal is committed to a plan that says, okay, we won't put quite so many new charges on our credit card each month.
But before we go any further, a couple of quick definitions. The national debt is the total amount the U.S. owes. It's currently about $14.5 trillion. So if we're looking at the nation's credit card bill, then the debt is the outstanding balance. The deficit is the difference between what the government spends each year and what it brings in. It's like the new charges listed on the bill. This year's deficit is expected to be about $1.4 trillion. Rogers says this deal doesn't do anything to pay down the debt or stop its growth, and it only does a little bit to the deficit.
It doesn't mean we've stopped using the credit card. It doesn't mean we are even paying down our credit card balance. It certainly doesn't mean we've cut up our credit card.
There are a couple of reasons why this is a problem. The more the federal debt grows, the more interest we have to pay on that debt, to the point where it starts crowding out other priorities. And even with this deal, Rogers says our deficits are so big, they're outpacing economic growth, which means the debt, compared to the size of the economy, will continue growing.
Which is a recipe for an unsustainable situation.
As Republican Senator Lindsey Graham said, we were running to the oblivion before. Now maybe we're just walking to it.
Mark Goldwine is policy director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, a bipartisan group calling for, you got it, deficit reduction. As part of the deal, the deficit trims come in two phases. Congress has agreed on nearly $1 trillion in discretionary and defense spending cuts. A so-called super committee of Congress is supposed to come up with the other $1.5 trillion in the next few months. Goldwine says that super committee should aim higher.
What they should be shooting for is about double their $1.5 trillion goal. They should be shooting for more like $3 trillion.
But to get there, Goldwine says members of the committee would have to do things that will make partisans on both sides mad. For Democrats, it would mean accepting tough changes to Medicare and Social Security.
We need to be looking seriously at the entitlements. That means making Social Security sound and solvent for the next 75 years through some painful adjustments like raising the retirement age or reducing benefits for high earners or increasing the amount of income subject to taxation.
And he says Republicans would have to accept revenue increases, a.k.a. taxes.
We must reform the tax code. We need to get rid of all of these deductions, credits, exclusions that really just riddle the tax code and cost us $1 trillion plus a year.
But for every tax break and every government program, there's a constituency that doesn't want it to change, which explains why it was so hard for Congress to settle on the deal it ended up with, and why it will be even harder to come up with a plan that would put a stop to that rising balance on the nation's credit card. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Relief from the resolution of the debt crisis didn't last long. Congress has finished its game of chicken over raising the federal debt ceiling, but the battle shook world markets and grim economic reports keep coming in. NPR's Tom Gjelten reports on the challenges ahead.
Over the last several weeks, Washington has been so focused on the wrangling over the debt ceiling that other economic issues went largely unheeded. Turns out the U.S. economy this year hasn't been performing nearly as well as we thought it was. The GDP barely grew in the first two quarters. Manufacturing is in worse shape than we realized. U.S. consumers actually cut their spending last month for the first time in nearly 2 years. When President Obama emerged from the White House yesterday to comment on the approval of a new debt ceiling, his message was essentially, don't get your hopes up, the economy is wounded.
It's pretty likely that the uncertainty surrounding the raising of the debt ceiling for both businesses and consumers has been unsettling and just one more impediment to the full recovery that we need.
In fact, even as the president was speaking, Wall Street was tanking. So were markets in Europe, which is struggling with a huge debt crisis of its own. Little wonder no one wants to buy stocks, says Harvard economist Kenneth Rogoff.
When everyone sees that global growth is slowing down, it's not just the U.S., we're also seeing China and Europe slowing down, they go, oh no, it's going to be harder than ever to dig our way out of this mess.
Just last year, prospects seemed brighter. After the financial crisis, the global economy rebounded, but that growth has now stalled in ways that remind us how the global economy is interwoven. China, for example, has been booming in part because of demand for its products in the U.S. and Europe. But Kenneth Rogoff points out that with U.S. and European consumers and businesses cutting back on their spending, even China gets hurt.
Although it's still growing, China's not collapsing at all. It's notably slowing, and it's being affected by the rest of the world, and all of these things connect. So we're seeing all the major regions of the world slow down, and it's not clear where growth is going to come from in the coming quarters.
Rogoff, the co-author of a book on the history of financial crises, points out that a slowdown like this is typical after a big financial crisis. In working so hard to get banks to lend again and consumers and businesses to spend again, governments drive themselves deep into debt. Cornell University economist Ishwar Prasad points out that government debt has become a burden for all the big Western economies.
And the high levels of government debt that exist in virtually every advanced economy are going to be a real drag on their growth.
Instead of promoting economic activity, those governments have to focus on financing their debt. Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, they're all having trouble getting banks to loan them what they need. And that prospect has investors here worried as well with regard to the U.S. future. It adds up to economic trouble for much of the developed world, and also to some realignments. The new economies, the emerging market countries, are in relatively better shape. Those that export to the advanced countries are affected by some of their export markets drying up. But Prasad points out that consumers in those countries, China, for example, are making up some of the difference. Plus, Prasad says, many of these new economies got their own budget deficits under control years ago, leaving them freer now to do more stimulus spending.
Most of the emerging markets have a lot more space in terms of their policies to prime the pump a little bit if needed to stoke their economies.
So the global economic landscape is shifting, and not in ways that benefit the U.S. or Europe. Economists say the powerhouses of the past could struggle for years to return to the prosperity they knew previously, even as new economies rise up to challenge them. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.